We're ready to begin another week of our 4.5-year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word. And I want to remind you that in 587 BC, the judgment of God was brought forth through the hand of the Babylonians in the destruction of the temple, of the city of Jerusalem, and of the ending of the kingdom of Judah, with pretty much the largest portion of the survivors of all that destruction being taken away into Babylonian exile. And there they settled in for what they'd been told was going to be about 70 years before the judgment was finished. And while they were there, they would have generated some psalms which expressed their sorrow and yet their hope in regards to all of these events and what was yet to come. So I've saved back some of the psalms that I suspect were written during this Babylonian exile time period. So open the book of the Psalms to number 74 first. Psalm 74. Now, many of these have superscriptions that may or may not have been inspired. It's hard to tell. But are probably more than anything instructions on what type of musical instrument to be used, or the style of music, or even the tune that was to be used whenever this psalm was sung. Sometimes it will have the name of the author or the composer. And so Psalm 74 starts with a maskil of Asaph. Now, maskil probably is a reference to the style of music that is to be used, although it could be the name of a specific tune. Asaph, that we know, is from the time period of David. And so the tune for this music may go all the way back to the time of David. But listen to the content, and you can hear that it's from the time period we're looking at now, the post-destruction of the temple period. O God, why do you cast us off forever? Why does your anger smoke against the sheep of your pasture? Now, sheep of your pasture, you'll see that in other psalms in a positive sense, that Israel, the chosen people, belong to God. They're His sheep. He's the shepherd. But here, it's the idea that God is the one that is angry with His sheep. And it feels as if He's abandoned them. Remember, the Psalms are to be understood with their emotional content. We should feel our way through these Psalms. Remember your congregation, which you've purchased of old, which you have redeemed to be the tribe of your heritage. Remember Mount Zion, where you've dwelt. So it's an appeal in this psalm for God to remember the past. Remember your kindnesses toward us and your relationship with us there at Jerusalem. Direct your steps to the perpetual ruins. The enemy has destroyed everything in the sanctuary. So here's the focus on the recent destruction of the temple. Your foes have roared in the midst of your meeting place. They set up their own signs for signs. So the Babylonians came in and they destroyed the temple. And then they set up apparently signage for some reason to direct the personnel of their army around. They were like those who swing axes in a forest of trees, and all its carved wood they broke down with hatchets and hammers. Interesting that the psalmist would use an image from some of the prophetic warnings that this was coming. God had talked about the Babylonians, and even before that, the Assyrians, being like woodsmen that he was calling into the forest of the different countries of the Middle East that needed judgment. And they were going to hack down the offending trees. And so here we have the image of those dismantling the temple building, hacking up all the fine woodwork that had been put in place back in the time of Solomon. That's all gone. Verse 7, they set your sanctuary on fire. They profane the dwelling place of your name, bringing it down to the ground. So yes, the temple is gone because of the judgment of God being administered through these Babylonians. They said to themselves, we will utterly subdue them. They burned all the meeting places of God in the land. So the psalmist is focusing on the attitude of the Babylonians, that they are thinking they did all of this at their own direction. And that's self-centered. And we do have other passages that God says, yes, I'm going to take in consideration that they had a bad attitude when they carried out some of this, and I will judge them eventually. And he will. There's an interesting note here. It says they burned all the meeting places of God in the land. For some reason, a lot of people give the impression that synagogues that came into existence at the time of the Babylonian exile and then exploded into the reestablishment of the Israelis into the Promised Land, that that all started later. And the word synagogue is a Greek word. It's got the idea of gathering together. But there is every indication that there were already meeting places for worship and prayer and fellowship elsewhere in the land of promise. The temple was the only place that you could offer sacrifices, but the temple was not the only place that people gathered for worship and fellowship and prayer. So there would have been tons of meeting places all over the Promised Land that were used throughout the year by the religious Israelis. And when the Babylonians came in, those places were taken down as well. Think of them as proto-synagogues or places of prayer and worship. Verse number 9, we do not see our signs. There is no longer any prophet, and there is none among us who knows how long. So they're not seeing the miracles that they had hoped. They hoped that God would step in at the last minute and rescue them all. And it says here, there's no longer any prophet. We still have Jeremiah and Ezekiel around after Babylon destroyed Jerusalem and the temple. But they were older gentlemen, and so they too may have passed by the time that this psalmist is inspired to express the emotion of the moment here. And here's the big emotion. How long, O God, is the foe to scoff? Is the enemy to revile your name forever? Why do you hold back your hand, your right hand? Take it from the fold of your garment and destroy them. And so this is an imprecatory prayer here, a curse prayer. The writer of this wants God to take his hands out of his pockets and do something to judge the Babylonians for what they've done. And when I say take out of the pockets, that's kind of what's being intimated here with take out of the fold of your garment, your hand. The fold of the garment would be in the bosom area, the chest area, and apparently people would keep things in that area for use and sometimes even rest their hands in that area, just like people put their hands in their pockets. So it's basically a call for God, do something. Don't just stand there. Verse 12. Yet God, my King, is from of old, working salvation in the midst of the earth. And now we get submissive to whatever it is that God will do. The acknowledgement that this is what I want done. This is why I'm so upset. But here is a reminder to perhaps self. God is God, and He will do things on His schedule to save us according to His promises. Because remember, already we've got promises made of restoration. That's clear in the writings of Jeremiah, and it's clear in the writings of Daniel and in Ezekiel. You divided the sea by your might. You broke the heads of the sea monsters on the waters. You crushed the heads of Leviathan. You gave him as food for the creatures of the wilderness. You split open springs and brooks. You dried up ever-flowing streams. These are reminders of the past, of how God has intervened supernaturally on behalf of the covenant people. Some of this is literal actions, and others of it might be metaphorical. We know that God took Israel through the flood of the Red Sea, through the flood of the Jordan, and brought them into the Promised Land. So that's literal. But we also know that there were prophecies in Ezekiel in particular, I think, as well as in Jeremiah, that God was going to break the monster of Egypt, which was metaphorically represented by a sea monster or a river monster called Rahab. And so that would have been a Leviathan or a sea monster. And so the promise was that it was going to be broken up and fed in judgment to other nations. And so that's all being thought of here. God's acted in the past. He will act in the future. Splitting open for water, we know that that happened in the wilderness experience. God gave them water out of a rock repeatedly during those 40 years. And then he also has the recent promise that we were talking about of a future river of the water of life. Verse 16, yours is the day, yours also the night. You have established the heavenly lights and the sun. You fixed all the boundaries of the earth. You've made summer and winter. So God, you're the creator. You put everything into place, including the season and weather cycles. Remember this, O he who is, how the enemy scoffs and a foolish people reviles your name. So as the creator, listen up to what they're saying. Do not deliver the soul of your dove to the wild beasts. Do not forget the life of your poor forever. Have regard for the covenant, for the dark places of the land are full of the habitations of violence. Let not the downtrodden turn back in shame. Let the poor and needy praise your name. So God, remember all your poor people in exile. Don't let the people of Babylon keep us here in subjugation. Arise, O God, defend your cause. Remember how the foolish scoff at you all the day. Do not forget the clamor of your foes, the uproar of those who rise against you, which goes up continually. So some of the experience of Israel going into Babylonian exile included trash-talking God. And so here is the psalmist saying, don't forget how they trash-talked you. Do something to bring us back. Let's go to Psalm 75 now. Similar situation. It's for the choir master according to something called Do Not Destroy, which might be a musical instrument or it might be a tune. A psalm of Asaph, a song. So Asaf might have generated the original music for this. Or it's also possible, and some commentaries make this suggestion, that maybe this is a later Asaf, named after his progenitor, that was writing during this time period. Verse 1. We give thanks to you, O God. We give thanks, for your name is near. We recount your wondrous deeds. At the set time that I appoint, I will judge with equity. When the earth totters and all its inhabitants, it is I who keep steady its pillars. Selah. So God is the one who says, I act at the appropriate times, and I do exactly what is needed. I say to the boastful, do not boast. To the wicked, don't lift up your horn. Do not lift up your horn on high or speak with haughty neck. A horn here would be like an animal horn, which was always symbolic of strength. And so it could be used both positive or negative. The Messiah is often referred to as the horn of God that will save. But also, the wicked leaders that have caused trouble throughout history are often referred to as horns. So God says, don't get all full of yourself. Don't stand up against me. For not from the east or from the west, and not from the wilderness comes lifting up, but it is God who executes judgment, putting down one and lifting up another. So God is the one that executes proper judgment and justice. And he lifts people up at the right time and takes them down at just the right time. For in the hand of he who is, there is a cup with foaming wine, well mixed, and he pours out from it, and all the wicked of the earth shall drain it down to the dregs. And you probably remember that Jeremiah was assigned to take a symbolic cup around to the different nations of the lower Middle East and tell them to drink it. This was a representation of the coming judgment by the hands of the Babylonians. If they drank it voluntarily, it would go better than if it was forced down their throats. And so here is God reminding us he's the one that mixed up that cup of judgment and expected it to be drunk. Verse 9, but I will declare it forever. I will sing praises to the God of Jacob. All the horns of the wicked I will cut off, but the horns of the righteous shall be lifted up. So praise and glory and honor and thanksgiving is due to God, because he will take down the bad leaders at the appropriate time. Let's go to Psalm 77 next. It's subtitled, To the Choir Master, According to Yadutan, which again, either a musical term or a musical instrument, a psalm of Asaph. Verse 1. I cry aloud to God, and he will hear me. In the day of my trouble I seek the Lord. In the night my hand is stretched out without wearying, and my soul refuses to be comforted. When I remember God, I moan. When I meditate, my spirit faints. Selah. Now, Selah, we've talked about this many times. It seems to be some sort of musical designation. It appears to mean either bring the music up or expand the music here or really make it prominent. It might have intended to give emphasis to what had just been sung or possibly a moment of contemplation in the midst of the song, to think about what's being sung. And what's being sung here is an appeal to God, an emotional appeal to God to intervene, to do something. Verse 4, you hold my eyelids open. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. So the writer of this apparently can't sleep. It's the middle of the night, and he feels he has to pray or sing to God about what's on his heart. I consider the days of old, the years long ago. I said, let me remember my song in the night. let me meditate in my heart. So he's thinking about perhaps back in the time before going into exile, and how even then he was singing in the night and talking to God. Then my spirit made a diligent search. Will the Lord, will he who is, spurn forever and never again be favorable? This is a question we saw asked in the earlier psalm. Is God writing us off? Has his steadfast love forever ceased? Are his promises at an end for all time? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his compassion? Selah. And of course, the answer to these questions are no. He's already said he will redeem them out of exile. So it might be that whoever's singing this is singing rhetorically. I will remember the deeds of he, excuse me, verse 10 I skipped. Then I said, I will appeal to this, to the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the deeds of he who is. Yes, I will remember your wonders of old. I will ponder all your work and meditate on your mighty deeds. So I'm going to go back to the past. I'm going to go back to the evidence of your past relationship with us, with Israel, with those of the covenant. And I'm going to anchor myself there. And this is the way that we're supposed to do as Christians. We're supposed to anchor ourselves in God's past actions, to see beyond a shadow of a doubt, he's always moving things in a direction to what is best for everyone that will seek his face. And so we as believers have got to be anchored in the past and move forward into the future based on that. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is great like our God? So if you want to compare him to all the idols, all the pagan deities, there is no comparison. He is holy. He is righteous. He does the right thing. He is compassionate and merciful. He designed us, and therefore he knows what's best for us and tries to move us in that direction. There is no comparison between God and the fallen angels who are God wannabes. You are the God who works wonders. You have made known your might among the peoples. God has caused his actions to be written down. By the time we're reading this, the larger portion of the Old Testament is already in written form and being circulated. And that includes many of the Psalms. And so these people know from past witnesses the mighty works of God. Verse 15, you with your arm redeemed your people, the children of Jacob and Joseph, Selah. And so the biggest story for the Jewish people that they can go back to, that talks about the mighty intervention of God, is the Exodus, and how God, with a mighty hand, mighty outstretched arm, redeemed them out of Egypt. And it looked like everything was done for them. They were slaves. They were powerless. And then God intervened. And so that becomes a lesson for them in exile. You might feel like everything is lost. You might feel like everything is beyond hope, but it's not, because we've been here before in slavery, in exile from the promised land, and God stepped in and brought us out with miracles. Verse 16, when the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. Indeed, the deep trembled. I love this passage. I love this verse. It makes me smile because it's a picture of the water of the sea being scared of God whenever he comes across the desert out of Egypt, leading his people to the water's edge. And eventually they are so scared they get out of his way. That's the poetic picture that we're seeing here. Verse 17, the clouds poured out water, the skies gave forth thunder, your arrows flashed on every side. The crash of your thunder was in the whirlwind. Your lightnings lighted up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Now, I think there's a combination of things that's going on in these couple of verses. You might remember that God sent as one of his plagues fire from the sky. And it seems to be this massive thunderstorm with hail and lightning, and it scared the Egyptians and killed a lot of their livestock. And that was one of the plagues toward the end to convince the Egyptians to let my people go. But God also sent his visible presence in the form of kind of a slowly revolving tornado, if you will, a whirlwind, which had lightning bolts striking out of that and thunder reverberating from it and shaking everything around it. And it was that presence of God that barricaded the chariot forces from coming anywhere near the Israelis as they crossed through the waters of the Red Sea. And then God, in that presence, cleared out the Egyptian chariot force by drowning them. Verse 19, your way was through the sea, your path through the great waters, and yet your footprints were unseen. So God took them through the sea, and then the sea went back into place, and there was no evidence of the passing, other than the dead bodies washing up on the shore from the chariot force. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. So it was like God taking his sheep across this area of the water to a new land and drowning all the wolves, all of the bears, all of the cougars that were trying to chase his flock down and harm them. And his two shepherds were Moses and Aaron.